From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Airbnb has faced lawsuits and other allegations of racial bias in its home-sharing platform. A Harvard Business School study in 2016 found that people with African-American-sounding names were 16% less likely to be accepted as Airbnb guests. The NAACP is partnering with Airbnb to prevent user discrimination and beyond that, to promote the service as an economic opportunity in communities of color here in Atlanta. GBB's Ross Terrell has been following the partnership. He's going to be posting the story later today, but is joining us with a preview. Welcome, Ross.
Hey, good morning.
So the NAACP is among organizations that have been critical of racism in Airbnb's sharing community. So what are some of those accusations?
Yeah, well, you have a few incidents. You have Black guests who were checking out of Airbnbs where police were called on them because, you know, people thought they didn't belong there. You also have instances where Airbnb had a housing policy where they could request a photo from you. And depending on how you looked, the host was able to cancel your reservation. And then there are other issues within the organization. When you talk about diversity of the workforce, engineers, suppliers, people who help the company, the NAACP says we need more representation in that area as well when it comes to weeding out some of these issues online.
So Airbnb has fined hosts who've canceled reservations based on race, and last year said it would no longer allow hosts to request guest photos before booking. What does this partnership aim to do to prevent bias?
Yeah, well, this partnership, one, it looks to increase diversity. Going out in communities, changing the narrative about Airbnb, and talking with some people from the NAACP, they say there's still a kind of misconception about what the service is and changing people's minds to allowing a stranger to kind of stay in your house. And then also working hand in hand with the company. One of the representatives from the NAACP, Marvin Owen, said, "We wouldn't be at the table if we didn't think this was real or relevant." So it's having a conversation, it's changing narratives, changing minds, and that's where they start.
Here is Marvin Owen speaking with you about the issue.
If you don't have access to affordable home ownership, then that destroys the opportunity to create wealth. So if you really want to create economic opportunity, you have to connect the dots with larger housing issues.
What is he talking about there, Russ?
Right. Well, as we know, there is an affordable housing problem here in Atlanta. And the Black home ownership rate in 2017 for African Americans was just below 45%. That's down 10% compared to a decade ago. But for whites, the homeownership rate was around 80%. So when you have new developments like the Beltline and Mercedes-Benz Stadium and that kind of tends to push people out, it's, well, how can I be a host if I can't afford to live in my neighborhood? And especially where a lot of African American population is on the west side, it's, we can't afford to stay here. We're being pushed out. So we can't even talk about hosting and having residents and making money because I can't afford to stay.
Are most Airbnb hosts homeowners? I mean, you have to have a spare room, clearly.
Right. So Airbnb doesn't track data on its hosts, but it is easier to be a host if you do own. If you rent, that then comes down to you and your landlord.
Right. That's, some landlords might say you can't.
Exactly. Some may say, sure, you have an extra room, go for it. But then you also have to wonder about what the city requires. And if you have a home ownership, do you have to get a business license, a hotel license? Are you now paying extra taxes? Is it worth it? So there are a lot of barriers that the NAACP and Airbnb hope to educate the African-American community about, but show them how to get into this market.
Okay. So for residents, it could mean making a little extra money. What's in it for Airbnb? Be?
Well, one, you expand the number of hosts on the site. Right now, we know in certain cities where African-American participation has increased, so has renting in those cities. That's increased. But then it's a matter of when you look at home sharing in Black communities, and we talk about the history of that and the idea that sometime that was the only place for Black people to stay. So now when you change this narrative and discussion about it, more people are willing to not only host, but you'll be more likely to then rent if you were visiting another city.
Now, we did talk on our show, and others have spoken about the Green Book Guide. This is that African-Americans used to find safe places to stay and eat while traveling in the Jim Crow era. Here's Janae Ingram from Airbnb. She seems to call upon that history.
I think, again, it's important for the narrative of home sharing for us as a community, the Black community, to be reminded that we have had home sharing in our community for hundreds of years, and it's a fabric of who we are, and that there is a space and place for us on Airbnb.
Ross, can you expand on that? I mean, how does this partnership touch on that history?
Well, you have to look at who's coming to the table. I mean, you talk about the NAACP, especially being here in Atlanta with the civil rights history. I've talked to a host, and she says, what better organization to have? And when you look at the NAACP being there through many legal issues, just the history and the clout that they have within the African-American community, that carries a little more weight than if you had a relatively new organization saying, hey, we should get involved. If the NAACP comes to the table and says, look, there's economic opportunity here. We got your back. In case anything happens, we're willing to go to bat for you. That really matters and carries some weight within these communities of color to get them involved in the service.
Well, and also for them to be pairing with a Silicon Valley organization, this old organization and this new organization.
Right. It's kind of like a clash of future and present, but dealing with the same issue, so to speak. And for the NAACP, one of their game changers, they have six of them. One of them was economic opportunity. And in speaking with their officials, they say, what better way is there than to leverage your home, which you own, to use more, to earn more money, which then can be an economic cushion should you fall upon hard times or for whatever reason. But now you're using something that you already own and you're benefiting from it.
Now, what kind of income are we talking about for a homeowner?
Well, according to Airbnb, if you just rent out a private room for two guests in your house, you're looking at about $850 a month.
Hmm.
If you have an entire space to rent out, so let's say you have an in-law suite or you own a rental property, something that degree, you're looking at about $2,000 a month just from renting that out. And that doesn't include the Super Bowl was just here, as we know. That weekend, charges went up.
Mad money.
People, I mean, made out very well. I talked to some hosts who say on the west side who were minutes away from the airport in downtown, and they said, we did very well. So there's opportunity there.
So how about, what are you hearing from neighborhood organizations? Those who, you know, are their residents on board with the goals of this partnership?
So I talked to a neighborhood organization over in West Park, and one of their board members is actually discussing this idea of doing it with her family. She has an in-law suite, which makes it a little unique and gives her a better chance to do it. But there is this hesitancy, this concern of, okay, so if property on the west side is cheaper, what's to stop real estate or stop developers from coming in, acquiring this, and then just renting it out for Airbnb?
Uh-huh.
And then does that not just turn us into a hotel district, and does that not price us out even more? And CJ Jackson, I talked to her, and she said there are some residents who rather see properties stay vacant then turn into rental property because it stokes fears of gentrification. Although there could be benefit there if I'm one of 10 on a block with an Airbnb, the resident or the guest has a chance to drive up, and if my neighborhood isn't up to par, they can leave.
Mm-hmm.
So now the city has to pay more attention. If I'm like, hey, I need zoning here. I need you to pick up maintenance on this side. Don't forget about this community.
We're speaking with GPB's Ross Terrell, who's been reporting on a new partnership between the NAACP and Airbnb. Yeah, well, let's get to that. I mean, cities work hard to beautify tourist districts, right? Planting flowers and keeping them clean, frequently patrolled by police. So if there's growth in Airbnb rentals in a neighborhood, could that give decision makers an incentive to care more about their upkeep?
I've heard two sides of this. I've heard from a host that now that I'm renting, it's up to me to kind of keep my street, my block up to standards. I've also heard that that's not where it should start, that it starts with voting. And when we talk about the West Side, we're talking about District 3, which is going through a special election. And some people in the neighborhood side are saying turnout for that was low. If you care about how your community looks, put people in office who are going to year-round, not just because you have a rental, not just because it's a big game coming, but who care about that community, put them in the office, show up and vote. And so you look at, you know, each side of it. If you're a host, you think, absolutely. You know, I've got people here. This is my business. I have a business license. It benefits the city when you talk about taxes. But then you have people who say, why does it require a rental property to get the city's attention and to get a city council member to actually help you out?
Yeah, so the market's driving here. Is Airbnb trying to partner with other cities, or is it just Atlanta?
Yeah, so they are. Atlanta is one of the first city of this year, one of the first in the Southeast, and one of the first overall. So currently they're in Miami, and that was pushed by the Florida NAACP chapter, and they kind of have the same reasoning. Also, as you mentioned, Airbnb is a Silicon Valley business, so they are out in the Bay Area. But there are also plans to move into Chicago, Dallas, New Orleans. So this is kind of a jumping off effort here in Atlanta, which, as we mentioned, it's not lost upon anyone, the civil rights history here. So how well this program does here could be a determinant for other cities and whether or not they would even want to get involved.
GPB's Ross Terrell, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Ross has been reporting on a new partnership between the NAACP and Airbnb, and you can read his story. It's going to be posted today at gpbnews.org. Savannah is known for its live oak trees dripping with Spanish moss. They are part of the city's history and its future. GPB's Cindy Hill takes us inside the Urban Tree Nursery Project, which is training apprentice arborists to grow and care for the city's famed tree canopy.
For see a tree or a plant to grow, the roots are everything. The heart, the mind, everything. Like, that's the whole body, is roots.
Come up with a design and we'll get the plants and you guys can put it together.
All right, sounds like a plan.
I'm Robert Hartwell. I'm 24 years old, and I got involved in this through the Chatham Apprentice Program, CAP program of Savannah. And they teach you how to get a job and be an employer and dress for success. And that's how I met Mr. Nick in the Green Ministry Project. They was talking about, landscaping and stuff like that.
You see those, right? So we've got more of those grasses popping up everywhere, but we're talking about this whole area. It's really hard to plant on.
Yeah, because of the
with the trees, that's why we skipped this whole area, all the roots. But what we could do is get some smaller flowering plants and a few shrubs and things and make a nice little landscaped area out of this. Save some of the flowers. So Nick Defley, I'm the director of sustainability at the city of Savannah, and we're standing on vacant city-owned properties that really needed a lot of love.
It looked like an empty lot that's had probably every former person and animal tracked through it at some point. It's had trash coming from the neighboring gas station littered all over the place. There were vines and weeds and fences riddled with holes and metal laying around. Hello, I'm Jason Smith. Now we have a bunch of trees surrounding us. Beautiful shrubbery. We got some sproutings going on. The grass is green. The sun is shining. It looks awesome right now.
We've got, I think, 10 different species of native trees. Some of them are also saltwater tolerant.
Trees gotta have life too. So we gave them a little drip tube right here. So all you do is cut the water system on and it frequently gives them a drip.
I think that the people is really the most important part of this project. You know, the trees are like kind of like the soil, and then the people are the plants coming out the soil, you know. As we're the ones that are really growing, the neighborhood is just taking this as a step forward. It's just a path.
Figure out a layout here, watch the fire ants. But bring those kids, too, to start teaching them, because they're younger, right?
Yeah, they're super young.
And just let them...
I can't help but see the trees now, like... And at night, when the lights are on and you're walking under them, it's like, wow, you know. God is good, and the people really can make a change. That's what this means. Like, we could be the change in the world just by planting a seed, you know?
For GPB News, I'm Cindy Hill in Savannah.
Stay with us. There's more on Second Thought coming up after a short break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Raymond Carr was raised by Christian clowns. Yep, you heard that right. Christian clowns.
It's pretty much what it sounds like. My parents were performing and ministering for churches that we grew up in, and we would travel around. And one of their aspects to entertain children and to draw them in was dressing up as clowns. It's all, you know, trying to keep the kids in the seats and, you know, as the adults went on for hours and hours above us. So,
how'd you travel?
And a giant pink bus that had clowns. No, it was just in a
in a little Volkswagen.
Yeah, exactly. In a tiny, tiny car that fit all of us in there. No, it was just by plane or driving.
Did you grow up thinking, this is great, I love this life? Or did you think, no way am I going to do puppets?
Yeah, you know, much like any kid, you don't realize how weird your situation is until someone tells you it is. So being homeschooled kind of helped insulate me from that a bit. And then by the time I was older, it was too late to turn back, I guess.
You could say that Raymond Carr went into the family business, and now he's thriving. He visited the GPB studio recently, and I talked with him about the prestigious Center for Puppetry Arts in Atlanta, where as a teenager, he overdosed on pizza and cake while performing for kids' birthday parties. He also worked on experimental productions there, and now creates things that stretch the limits of puppetry. Tiny worlds and characters for music videos and films, and building large-scale animatronic dinosaurs. His company, Ninja Puppet Productions, has produced award-winning shorts and shows and worked for companies like Dropbox and the Georgia Aquarium. And it's not all kid stuff.
I'm an adult, maybe that's obvious, but I've been performing for adults as well for a long time, and that's what I love to do. I mean, I'm certainly not just the children's performer, and you know, that's something that's resonates through, I think, most puppeteers, is they have a drive to explore adult ideas and themes through puppetry as well.
Raymond is one of few accomplished African-American puppeteers. He got his big break as an understudy for the role of Pixel in Nickelodeon's LazyTown show.
It's a
Now Raymond plays Dunk the Pufferfish on the Jim Henson Company show Splash and Bubbles. A lot has happened in between. Plenty of successes and a few fails.
Yeah, I had a couple of those. You know, I think the way that, at least with the avant-garde arts, failure is has a much broader term, because there's certain things in the performance where I am trying to convey an idea behind this show, or I'm trying to like make people laugh or make people cry or like just have some sort of theme. And those themes weren't connecting with the audience. And yeah, it may have been an interesting show, or it may have, you know, not run out in fear or terror, but it's, for me, there was like, oh, they didn't get what I was trying to do. So that was like a failure on that level, less than like the stage falling down or lights exploding or something.
None of the slapstick failures.
Yeah, it was not quite Noises Off, although I think I probably have been in a few shows like that. But
do you think artists learn more from their successes or from their failures? Or how about you, speaking for everybody?
Yeah, I don't know if I respond well to positive feedback. I need a nice kick in the butt every now and again to get me going. So a failure usually does that.
You worked also in animatronics with this other production, Walking with Dinosaurs, mm-hmm. creating large-scale animatronic puppets. But could you explain just what animatronics is?
Right. So, I mean, animatronics is, I could really geek out and go deep dive, but
how about medium geek?
Okay, medium deep dive. medium geek out. So, animatronics is just a catch-all term for animated robots. So, everything from, you know, Hall of Presidents at Disney World to creatures in Star Wars, all of these things are essentially just puppets that are operated generally remotely with some sort of sophisticated cable-driven interface or machinery. So, yeah, that's basically what it is. So it's a pretty broad term.
So if we were, you know, watching, you did dinosaurs, mm-hmm. right? If we were watching Jurassic Park, are those dinosaurs animatronic?
Some of them are. You know, they really, certainly the original Jurassic Park, yes. And there was some CG, obviously. And now they've gotten really, really good at blending the two so well that at times even I can't tell what is CG and what is practical. And sometimes they blend the two. Sometimes it'll be like, the eyes will blink and that's CG, but the body is a practical puppet and things of that nature.
So if you are working on a character that is a puppet in like a CG movie or mm-hmm. production, What is that like? I mean, you were talking about the kind of high wire act of doing something live in front of an audience, but suddenly you're working with something not in real time in a green screen.
It really depends on the level of imagination that you're required to do. Oftentimes, you know, we'll be performing and the thing that is CG is the background. So it's just you're in front of a green screen, but you know, other performers are right next to you. So that's less of a thing. But there is certainly a suspension of disbelief that you have to embrace, knowing that it's going to look different on the other end of the screen. So. But oftentimes what's great about these animatronic creatures is the fact that they do look so real that if you're working with a real performer, they're the ones who are touching the creature and like interacting with it. So it's so much more fun and better for the performance as opposed to just standing in front of a blue ping pong ball.
Have you actually ever been inside of one of those creatures as a puppeteer?
I have.
That's what you do.
Definitely. I've done some stuff for Cartoon Network and various other productions where I've been inside. I rarely am inside of it, but I do that. Yeah.
How about the Walking with Dinosaurs production?
So Walking with Dinosaurs was a live show that's back on tour now, actually, in Europe. And it's life-size animatronic dinosaurs that took three people to operate, one in the base, one operating the face, and one operating the body. And they would roam around these arenas. We played like the Phillips Arena and Madison Square Garden and Staples Center. So big arenas. Except we would operate the puppets about 100 yards away, like where you would see like the sound booth or something like that, far, far, far away. And so you had to rely on the blocking of the show and your rehearsal and what visual cues you had and your other teammates to really make it come to life.
And you were head of puppetry for that show,
We called ourselves the voodoo puppeteers because we operated remotely like a voodoo doll. I was head of voodoo puppetry for about 2 years.
But that's a huge production. Yeah. What was that like? I mean, $20 million production, what I read.
Right. Yeah. No, it was about $20 million. We traveled with 75 people and 25 semi-trucks. We were the fourth largest touring the show in the world at the time that I was on it. I don't know what it is now. But the show was amazing. It's to this day, like, audience reactions when the T-Rex comes out and roars in their faces, and the sounds would come from the dinosaurs. The Brachiosaurus is 40 feet tall. The audience would just freak out. Nothing like it. And so, like, that's was a lesson in spectacle, I think, for me. It's like really showing that people aren't jaded enough to, they can still be affected by theater and spectacle.
When you collaborated on a short film there called Monster Guard, it's this reclusive Icelandic man in a cabin kind of trying to stave off the demons of his past. And you can actually hear them. But the sound is mostly whirling wind outside and silence. This theme of isolation that I see in some of these works that you've done, you know, like there's this character, Saren, in another short, was called Wild in the Wind, kind of drowning in her own self-destructive behavior, right? And she's in communication with this kind of grotesque, gelatinous being named Wick. And she lashes out at him as he tries to help her.
Forgive me. You need to forgive me. I mean, you just started taking breath a couple of weeks ago, and now you're handing out forgiveness? God, who do you think you are?
So what are you exploring here? I mean, thoughts and memories or conscience given form?
It's certainly not really, like, memories outside of the abstraction. You know, I'm really interested in, like, role reversals. Specifically, like with stuff like both of those pieces, actually, the monster or the creature or the bad guy, it may look grotesque and weird and all those things. And yet we suddenly realize that that is not the real monster. The real monster is the person or the emotions that they're dealing with and all these other kinds of esoteric, artsy-fartsy explanations. I like the idea of, and that's one thing that puppetry can give you, is because you walk into seeing a monster and you have your expectations set a certain way, and then by the end of it, it's flipped on its head. And, you know, Jim Henson did this a lot too. I mean, the Sesame Street creatures were referred to as monsters, you know. So he definitely has that sense of just getting you to look at something in a different way.
And he used some, I'm going to say, Henson-esque puppets for a music video. You've made a couple of them, actually, mm-hmm. not so Henson-esque, but Atlanta-based chamber pop band Little Tybee, mm-hmm. and a sort of Muppet-like creatures for the heavy metal band Mastodon.
Yes.
So what's the process of turning a song into a visual story?
You know, that was a lot of fun. That was in production with the Cartoon Network. And the music video is called Deathbound, and it was actually their idea. Like, they came to us with the idea, which was like, and you know, a lot of times you get these pitches where it's like Sesame Street, but it's for adults. Get it? And you just hear that a lot. And so this was like, it's like Mr. Rogers, but it's for adults. And at first I was like, all right, whatever. But we went in there and just made it crazy. We had dozens and dozens of puppets in this giant landscape that was Storyland, just exploding and fighting and just causing chaos and mayhem. And we had so much to shoot in such a little time that we were just like literally throwing puppets around, getting smoke machines. And then there's a castle that explodes at the end and I'm running away with it in the puppet. It was just an air explosion, but still there was quite violent, but that was a lot of fun.
It's rock and roll. Let's hear.
It's definitely rock and roll.
Hi, kids. Today we're going to talk about the solar eclipse. You see, the solar eclipse is when the moon passes in between the Earth and the sun. It looks like this. Sometimes it can have a strange effect on people and makes them do things they normally wouldn't do. Oh, hey, Bells. Gee, I hope our friends in Magic Land are doing okay.
That, of course, is the beginning of the Deathbound video for Mastodon.
Yes.
But it is a play on Mr. Rogers, mm-hmm. the little trolley mm-hmm. going through. Did you watch that show?
Of course, yeah. Yeah, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was, yeah, very influential.
Well, it's completely low tech, which is so funny. I mean, he played all of the puppets. But did you see the film Won't You Be My Neighbor?
I did.
The documentary?
I did see Won't You Be My Neighbor, actually, at the Atlanta Film Festival.
It was such a beautiful film. I just saw
it. I mean, just from the opening sequence, there was just ugly crying throughout the entire audience. Like, you could just hear sniffling as the soundtrack. It was so intense and beautiful. It was so beautiful.
Well, one of the interesting things there is, I kept forgotten the woman's name, but she was worked on the production, and she said that Fred Rogers used puppets to say things that he couldn't. I mean, I'm not just saying, you know, the lesson du jour, you know, the sort of anti-war message or love people,
yeah, sure.
but as a mask. Mm-hmm. Is that true for you?
I think it's more, I generally don't have a whole lot of trouble not having trouble saying things. But I think it is kind of a way to articulate and have people, you can say things all day long. We hear it all the time. You're on the radio and you can talk all day long, but sometimes just saying the thing isn't the best way to communicate the idea. Sometimes communicating an idea more effectively is through another means, which is visual, which is metaphor, which is satire, all these things that puppetry do so well. So it's less, I think, for me specifically about not being able to say things, and this is enables me to do that, and more so just communicating something more effectively with puppetry.
My guest today is Atlanta-based puppeteer Raymond Carr, but that's obviously kind of a limiting title for the work that you've done, Raymond. He plays Dunk the Pufferfish on the Jim Henson Company's new PBS show, Splash and Bubbles. So we've talked about making music visible, creating monsters, a lot of different hats. Is there a favorite aspect of this for you?
You know, I find that I have creative ADD. So if I'm not doing one thing, I'd want to be doing the other. It just keeps me interested in all those things. And honestly, it doesn't, for me, there's a symmetry that goes along with all of it. And it does. And it sounds a lot like a lot of different things, but it's all very similar in the actual techniques of creating something, bring it to life.
You mean your process
exactly.
of just sort of thinking something through?
Right.
How do you do that? I mean, obviously that's a big process, but are you one of those like, I've got to be, you know, at my desk every morning at X o'clock or?
I would like to say that. I just bought an elliptical machine, so that's helping me in my office. No, I, If I'm not on a job, I try and keep as much of a schedule as possible. I'm doing a lot of writing right now and developing different projects, so I have to maintain. I can't just, you know, wake up at noon and then go to a coffee shop and write. I got to try and be productive. But for the most part, it has a lot to do with, if I'm in the creative mindset, my eyes are constantly looking for something. I'm looking for an object, an image, a sound, a clip, and I will write stuff down. I'll record something on my phone, anything to try and solve the problem of that creative formula.
That's Atlanta puppeteer Raymond Carr. He plays Dunk on the PBS television show Splash and Bubbles. His company, Ninja Puppet Productions, is currently crowdfunding for a new sci-fi movie. It features three kids from the inner city who stumble upon a dying alien who gives them power to fly a spaceship. There's more information at our website, gpbnews.org. Stay with us. We'll hear from an author and photographer about her book highlighting the strength and sensitivity of boyhood. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. With her book, Strong is the New Pretty, author and photographer Kate T. Parker showcased girlhood in all its messy, muddy glory, with portraits of girls whose beauty came from being their authentic selves. Now she's doing the same thing with boys. The Heart of a Boy is out today, and it celebrates the strength and spirit of boyhood. Little Shop of Stories will be selling the book at the Mason Fine Art Gallery on Sunday, April 7th, where she will be appearing and speaking and signing. And she joins me now in the studio. Kate, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about Strong as the New Pretty. I know it's not the new book, but this was a photo series first and then a book showing a range of portraits of girlhood. Now you're focusing on boys. Were you planning this follow-up all along?
No, I did not want to shoot this book about boys. I'm a mom of girls, and my publisher actually asked me, would I consider doing a book about boys as a follow-up? And then every single talk I did on the tour for Strong as the New Pretty, and I spoke to thousands of kids and girls, little boys would say, you know, where's my book, Miss Kate? When are you doing a book about boys? And I was like, you guys do not need a book. You're fine. Your voices are heard. I was like, I am amplifying girls' voices, and I'm on a mission to show girls that they're strong and confident and beautiful. And my idea, because I didn't spend a lot of like day-to-day time with boys, was I thought our boys were fine. But kind of to play nice, I told my publisher I would try. Like 100% expecting to come back and say, didn't work, let's do Strong as a New Pretty too. But the first few shots that I took and first few boys that I met, I was floored by the variety of and the depth of feeling and the vulnerability that these boys were willing to share. And I realized that their stories are not being told. And I started to feel sort of less of a, I have to do this, and more like, oh my gosh, we need to start this conversation.
So who were the first boys that you photographed? Curious.
They were boys that were local to me. So I started with my best friend's son, Mason, who I dedicated the book to, who was constantly asking me, where is my book? Because he has two older sisters. And I started with another little boy, Patrick, in my neighborhood, who was just very quiet and a very shy little boy who I knew. But when I got to shoot him, I just found out much more about him, that he, you know, he loved his cats. And just like all of these details that I didn't know because I just met them surface, you know, and I feel like that's a lot of what people might think, that, you know, your first view is your view of the boy, and we expect our boys to be a certain way. And even in 2019, the definition for what is acceptable for a girl to be is pretty narrow. But I realized that for a boy, it's even more narrow. So I was trying to help expand that definition just a little bit.
So what is the process for you? Do you spend time with them? You ask them about their lives, and mm-hmm. you're taking photographs all along?
Oh, 100%. So usually I shoot with the girls and the boys, I'm getting to shoot the kids doing the thing that they generally love the most, the thing they're most passionate about, whether it's art or theater or sports, whatever it is. So I just generally ask about like, oh, what are you doing or what do you like to do? What was your day like? Tell me about soccer or tell me about singing or violin, whatever. So I get these kids when they are at their most confident and they're really proud of what they're doing. So I feel like I kind of get a leg up on getting them comfortable.
So I've seen, looking at a picture now of Alexander L., age 12. He's playing the piano. His eyes are closed. He's in it. He says, playing the piano helps me express my feelings.
Mm-hmm. He's so passionate. And he was shaking his head around. And he was 100% into this playing the piano. And I just love that passion. And he was not embarrassed. He was not embarrassed to show me. He was not embarrassed to be photographed and in a book being passionate about music. And I just admire that so much in people and especially in younger kids. And I think that's something that we as adults kind of forget, you know, how we used to be and how we used to be like all in on everything and so passionate. So I hope that this kind of helps remind us of who we used to be and who we used to think we could be.
Right, before we became guarded and thought about the image that was out on Facebook.
Exactly.
Or Instagram or whatever.
Like, oh, it's not cool to be passionate.
Well, you also show boys doing ballet, but mm-hmm. in action poses and running and doing sport, you know, on the beach, doing yoga, playing an instrument like we just mentioned. What are you hoping boys and their parents see in, as you said, this expanded definition of boys?
Well, I hope we can accept our kids for who they are, not who we expect them to be. And I think that allowing our kids to kind of the space to explore what they are interested in and just maybe it's not necessarily fighting for your kids because we are all willing to fight for our kids. But sometimes it's just saying, oh, yeah, do you want to try that? Go ahead. And just kind of like clearing the path for our kids to be who they are and supporting them along the way.
And how did you choose who to photograph?
So diversity is a huge part of trying to make sure that these books are successful. I want to make sure that anybody picking up the book finds somebody that they inspires them and that they feel that they can relate to. So I really shot all over the country and I tried to capture, like I had a list at the beginning of activities and kinds of boys I wanted to capture, but that's really where I start. And then I get so many different, like it's all through social media. Mm-hmm. So I find all these kids.
People say, we want you to photograph our boy.
Mm-hmm. Or I'm saying, I'm looking for amazing stories of boys in San Francisco. And then there's so many things that I had never thought of that was on my original list, which I kind of hope and expect.
Like what?
So there was a boy in San Francisco, actually, where I shot, where I was going to shoot, was Mormon. Mm-hmm. And his complete interest and talents lay in makeup. He came fully made up, loved makeup, loved designing his own clothes. I hadn't, like, set out to find – that was such a specific thing. But he was so talented and so invested in this and fully supported by his parents. And I just was like, this is exactly what I'm hoping to capture, to show boys that your interests can lie anywhere and that's okay.
So was it hard or was anyone resistant to being captured doing their passionate thing or just showing themselves?
I don't want anybody to be a part of a project. Like, I don't want to push anybody. I want you to be proud to be part of this. And I think Strong is New Pretty helps sort of like lay out what they could expect. And so I would send like excerpts of that book and say, this is kind of what we're looking to do for boys. I want people to be proud of it.
But, you know, sometimes a kid, once they get in front of a camera, they might get shy.
Oh, for sure. But I think by having that option of like them doing the thing they love, they're really proud of it. And it makes kids comfortable because I also when I shoot, it's not like look at me and smile. It's more like a motion set. Like I'll be like, do that thing, throw the ball, go pick that up. Oh, wait, stop here. Move this. You know, I'm giving direction all the time because they're, you know, the kids I'm working with are not models. They're not professionals. So it's more about just like running them through a series of actions to capture the most natural way that they look.
Yeah, I'm looking through the book and most every kid is like, some are side views, mm-hmm. but most of them just looking straight on at the camera. So there's projecting something. Although there's a really kind of an adorable one, Gus. He's kind of curled up on a chair with his glasses. He's 4, and he says, "I'm proud I wear glasses, even though I don't like them."
Yeah, I mean, he kind of leaned down, put his glasses in his hair, looked like Cousin It, and I did not ask him to do that, but I was like, of course, like, stay, hang on, 1 second. It's adorable.
I'm speaking with the photographer and author Kate T. Parker. Her new book is called The Heart of a Boy. So how do you experience this differently as a photographer or a person taking pictures of girls versus boys?
It was totally different for me. And like I said, I was kind of resistant in the beginning. But once I got over that worry that I was abandoning our girls, it just was kind of like, it was exactly like Strong as New Pretty. And once I realized that this is necessary and this is something that I really felt passionate about turning my lens on and sharing and sort of exposing and trying to help start that conversation, it was exactly the same thing. I love it. It's funny because I love the creation of the books so much. I love making them. And then right now, as they come out, I hate it. It makes me so nervous.
Why?
I just, you know, it's like it's your baby and I love it and I believe in it. And I think it's really like such great image. Like, I'm really proud of it. And then I don't want that to change based on, you know, oh, does it sell or does, you know, what are, because I fully expect there to be backlash. There was backlash with Strong as New Pretty. And it's just trying to get sort of that thicker skin for myself to be like, it doesn't matter. If you're proud of it, it doesn't matter.
What was the backlash for Strong as a New Pretty, that you weren't presenting silver bells and cockle shells? I can't even remember. Yes. What are little girls made of?
I mean, I think that was the problem with Strong as a New Pretty, is that people thought I didn't present the other side of girls that did like princesses and girls that did like to dance and dress up. But I did. If you open the book, you would have seen it. So, you know, people would say, what's wrong with my daughter? She likes to play with dolls. And I was like, there's absolutely nothing. If you look on page, whatever. Like, but I think the cover, because the cover was very confident and athletic, that people just looked at a few pictures and sort of made their determinations.
So you are a mother of daughters, mm-hmm. right? And you did talk to, as you're taking these photographs, boys and their mothers. What kind of things did you hear from them about the challenges of, you know, you said boys are okay, they're doing just fine.
Yeah, I think that these mothers and fathers and the boys themselves were really happy to have somebody start this conversation, because they were like, oh, well, my son plays football, but he has such a great heart. Nobody ever recognizes that about him or encourages that about him. And I think it's just recognizing that kids, boys and girls, are multidimensional, and that we can hold like multitudes in ourselves, and that you can be strong and confident and then also kind and vulnerable at the same time, and that's okay. I think it's recognizing sort of that complexity that, you know, a one note, boys are this way, girls are this way, doesn't allow for.
Well, and we know right now with a lot more gender fluidity mm-hmm. in our culture, but also like high profile men being called out for toxic and harmful behavior, especially in regards to women and girls. You know, kids, what's happening to our boys, the school shootings or... So when you're looking at these photos, when you're taking pictures of these boys, what are the things that you're concerned about?
So I mean, I think I'm very concerned with all those things. And I think if we start when they're young, our boys will recognize that in our girls. And as they grow up, they will allow, you know, it's just allowing everyone to be their true selves, and they will recognize it in each other. And as they grow up, then hopefully that change starts generationally. It's like starting at the bottom. And then, yes, boys and men are in our power positions. But if this generation grows up with this idea that, no, I don't have to be, then it's sort of making this shift or altering the paradigm a little bit.
Yeah. I'm also wondering about, you know, there's been so much written about like what happens to girls' self-confidence as they hit their tween and teenage years. And boys, too. Yeah, we've all seen those boys, you know, sort of start staring at the ground after being these proud little boys. I wonder what it would feel like them to see these pictures in 10 years.
Yeah, I hope it does the same, you know, that Strong as New Pretty did for girls and women. They recognized themselves, or they saw themselves, or they remembered something about themselves. I hope that these images do the same for boys.
Has this series of book influenced how you're looking at raising your own kids and, you know, messaging to them about who they are and what they can become?
Well, definitely. Like, I mean, I'm a pretty open person, and the fact that I hadn't seen that this was necessary, and or that I had just dismissed that this was a conversation we needed to have for our boys, made me realize how much more we need to have this conversation. I feel like we're sort of, we're much farther along in the conversation with our girls. It's pretty acceptable for our girls to be loud and confident and
traditionally boyish.
Yes, yeah. But I don't think the same is true for our boys to be softer or more feminine. I feel like we're not quite there yet. So, and it's funny, when my publisher was looking to find a comparable book for Heart of a Boy to, you know, like compare how many did we print, they couldn't find one.
Huh.
So they had to look at Strong's New Pretty, which is similar, but it's not the same subject matter. So it was interesting to me to realize, oh, there's not a lot out there for our boys. Like, there is a million books for our girls to embrace who they are, but there's not as many for our boys.
Oh, so you're answering a need you didn't even know was there.
Or I didn't think was there.
Yeah. So has the work that you've done around these images, shooting boys and girls, changed the way you shoot with adults now?
Well, I think, yeah, I think anytime I shoot with these personal projects, I learn something, and it's always about connecting with my subject and trying to figure out how do you as a photographer, I feel like it's my role to let their true self shine through and let their beauty and then like their sense of who they are shine through. And you can do that through, you know, just through conversation or really just allowing and asking about who they are. And then if you have the opportunity to let them do it, then you're golden.
Are there any boys in particular? I know, maybe it's like saying your favorite child. you know, any in particular that really stood out for you, that as a story of a boy that you met, you encountered, and you had that connection with that just stayed with you?
So there was this one family that I met. They were the Cassidys, and it was three boys and their mom. And they were traveling the entire country in an RV by themselves for a year. And mom was homeschooling the boys, and they were getting, it was just the coolest thing ever. 100%, I do not want to travel an RV with my kids and homeschool them for a year. But recognizing that what doesn't work for me doesn't mean it's wrong. And the other thing, the super interesting thing about the Cassidys was every single family member was deaf. And the courage to sort of live your life in the way that you want, and with a disability that you are like, I just was so impressed with what my mom was sharing with her boys. Like, we got this. We can do this. We're on our own. I can teach you. I can show you all these places. I can drive this giant RV. I was just so impressed with how they kind of lived their life unconventionally and were unapologetic about it.
It sounds as if Strong as the New Pretty 2 is going to come out sometime. Is that so?
Oh, yeah. So I'm working on, yeah, the next book I'm working on is about courage in girls and women. So kind of bringing women into the fold this time.
Okay. And how about, you know, what's the oldest boy or girl that you photographed?
About 20, I think, is sort of the top age range limit.
Well, KT Parker, congratulations on your new book, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Author and photographer Kate Parker, her newest book, The Heart of a Boy, is out today, and she's going to be in Atlanta on Sunday, April 7th. She'll be at Mason Fine Art Gallery, and Little Shop of Stories is going to be selling books there. You can find more information on the event at our website, gpbnews.org. That's our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alec Caslow is our engineer, and Amy Kiley is senior producer. I'm Virginia Prescott. Make sure you keep the conversation going. We're on Facebook. Our group is at GPB Radio's On Second Thought. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. See you next time.